Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
You're listening to 100 Words or Less with Ray Harkins.
Hello, everyone. I hope you are doing great this day or evening or whenever you're listening to it. I welcome you to this platform in which we have discussions with people who are involved in independent music, whether it's punk or hardcore or indie rock or emo, whatever it is, as long as it's of the DIY variety, that is what we care about here. And obviously that's what you care about. So first of all, if this is your initial time checking out this podcast, I appreciate it. If this is your 500th time, I also appreciate it. Today, I have a great guest. He is an old friend. And I mean old just by the length of time that I know him, not like an old human being, even though technically he is. He's probably the same age as me. But regardless, his name is Ezra Morris. He sang for a band called Downpour that eventually changed their name to The Power and the Glory, who put out some records with Deathwish and also his previous band, Downpour, that it kind of morphed into. They put out records with Jock Recordings. And basically, Ezra is a great dude. Him and I met many years ago in the early 2000s, I think, when I started to book some shows here in Southern California, and we played together across the country in very random times, and it was always great to see him. We got along very, very well, but he has led a very interesting life in regards to playing in bands, working at record labels, working at media. He's done a lot of different things. And he was participating in the hardcore scene in Atlanta that I thought was always really, really cool. Like very, you know, warehouse living heavy, where it was like, you know, 10 people posting up in a place, throwing shows there, living there, screen printing their own shirts. Like, it was just really, really cool. Like, that was definitely a time and a place. And I just always admired that because us here in Southern California, we didn't really have anything like that. You know, we had punk houses that, you know, I was fortunate enough to live at one, and there were many others, but that whole sort of like warehouse where there's like, you know, 10 to 15 people living in a spot, all paying like, you know, $200 in rent. Like, it was a very romantic idea. I like that idea. So anyways, Ezra, very intelligent dude, and I loved having this conversation with him. So that's what we got. You can always email the show, 100wordspodcast@gmail.com. You can leave a rating and review. It costs you $0, and it supports the show in a very real way on the Apple Podcast page. It just helps the algorithms shoot this podcast out to the people who need to listen to it. You can also leave a rating on the Spotify platform if you listen to the podcast there. And also, there is a link in the show notes for you to follow along on YouTube, because I publish all of the episodes there, because people love to listen to podcasts on YouTube. That's not how I prefer to listen to podcasts, but that's neither here nor there. And plus, it's a great discovery mechanism. You know, people are are looking up interviews with people, and then boom, the podcast appears, and then there we go. We got another one. So anyways, all of those things are greatly appreciated. I was a two shout outs real quick. One to the Wheel of Life here in Southern California. It is a vegan restaurant institution, has been in business for 30 plus years. They recently closed up shop and it broke my heart, but you know, an amazing run. And the amount of friends that I spent time eating with there over the years was just innumerable. And, you know, it's always sad to see one of those like staple institutions where people would go there like before a show, eat dinner, and then, you know, go hang out. It was great. So shout out to them. And also shout out to Program. I've been going to a lot of shows there recently and I love what they do. They create an amazing space for bands to play. I saw Back to Godhead and Stateside and Moral Law and then Abstain, even though I missed them, unfortunately, but got to watch that show and it was really cool. It gives me all the warm fuzzies in regards to just like hanging out with friends in a parking lot and then going inside a skate shop and watching bands play. I love that. So shout out to Program here in the Southern California area for building a great space for bands to play. So anyways, here's my discussion with Ezra Morris from Power and the Glory and Downpour, and in my mind, an Atlanta hardcore legend.
You were for sure, and I know that many of your friends are probably like this, where I can't recall the actual first time that we met, but I'm fairly certain where I think Downpour was coming through Southern California on a tour, and I'm fairly certain I booked a show for you, likely at Coos Cafe, and then, if I am not mistaken, I think you stayed at my parents' place, but all of these facts could be completely wrong.
So, I don't think we ever played Coos.
Okay,
you booked a show or you let us jump on a show that I think was at the Ojai Women's Center.
Okay, that, yes. Thank you for jogging that memory. But yes, you're correct. That was right. Yeah, I remember they actually stopped doing shows there, but now it's random, but Fiddlehead is playing a show there in like October. And I'm like, they haven't played a show there in like, you know, 15 years or whatever. But yes, you're correct. But what I do remember beyond the fact that I'm completely misplacing a show that, you know, apparently we played together and that I misremembered that, but I knew that you and I became like fast friends where it was one of those things where we just kind of, you know, our senses of humor melded and we just obviously enjoyed each other's company. And it's interesting to see like how those bonds can obviously hold over time. And I'm sure you have that experience with other people where it's like, oh yeah, I don't need to like see them every week, month, year, or whatever, but you could just like slide right back in that. Do you reflect on that? Is that one something that, you know, you experience with others from that perspective?
Yeah, you know, it really is. I mean, I think you know, there's that shared sense of history, like and just, you know, instant rapport that you can pick up with people. But I think also the kind of people that were willing to sort of, I don't go through the the insanity, the trials and tribulations of playing in bands in the 90s and early 2000s, just like reflecting on things like, you know, if you're willing to go on tour or even on a road trip with like nothing but a phone number and like the name of the city you're supposed to show up in a month, that's a particular kind of person that's willing to do that. And then it's a particular kind of people that continue to do it. So yeah, there's definitely people that, and it's interesting because there's not like a shared thread, you know, there's people like you who you're like such a friendly, wholesome guy. And then there's people that are like, you know, like Jamie Getz from Turmoil, who's just a total maniac, but just another person that, you know, I can go 10 years not seeing him and just pick up. Not that you two may know each other for all I know, but just
we do.
Different kinds of personalities, you know?
You are very, I appreciate both those comparisons because, I mean, yes, that is the vibes that everybody is giving off, but it's like, to your point that if you are here, as in the collective here, if you are here at the show, if you're playing in this band, if you are, you know, taking photos of a show, you have deliberately showed up and there's that like weird social contract that almost, you know, is assumed when you enter these rooms that like, oh, I probably should be friends with you, but like, we just haven't met yet or whatever.
Right. And I definitely didn't have the attitude when I was younger. Like, it took me some distance to realize like, oh yeah, you know, this person's about, well, they're 99% of the way there of being interested in things that I'm interested in. But you know, they sort of, the energy and the hostility of youth, I think probably prevented me from sort of like making a lot of connections back then, or just like that shared sense of, I don't know, when we were playing in bands, like this sense of like being competitive with people or being wanting to, you know, really express, you know, push your ego out into the world or something. Kind of it was sort of a roadblock for me sort of realizing back then that sense of connection, which has been an interesting thing now, years and years later, to reconnect with people or to sort of meet people again for the first time, just in a different context, but with that shared sense of history.
Right. And I'm sure to your point too, just because you have traveled in the, you know, media / creative space for, you know, the better part of your adult career / life, that you do run into people who have that experience and are just like, oh, I had the same, you know, things as you, except we just grew up from, you know, thousands of miles from each other, but like same sort of vibe.
Oh, 100%. Just recently, I was talking with this guy who my girlfriend and I just recently moved in together in the past year or so. And I was talking to this guy that had been her neighbor for probably 3 or 4 years prior to that. And I was just kind of like, oh yeah, what's up, dude? You know, he's just kind of, he's a friendly guy, friendly enough, but you know, I'm always a bit like cagey about being like, I was in a band and I don't really necessarily want to elaborate beyond that sort of thing when you're navigating certain sort of social situations, but especially professional situations. But we started talking, he kept sort of just pressing me. And then at some point he was like, well, you know, he gave me a clue that maybe, maybe he had some sort of shared background, but he was like, oh yeah, you know, I used to be really into this band, Song of Zarathustra. And then,
Oh yeah.
And then I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. I was like in a band. We were like converged, blah, 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 blah. And then he was like, oh yeah, me and my friends used to book Mac Rock. And this is like a dude that I've been interacting with now for, you know, like 6 or 7 years. And then instantly I was like, oh yeah, okay. Like, it completely changed my entire perspective on it. But it was that sort of thing where I was like, oh yeah, okay. Then now I can like kind of relate, you know?
Right. It's like you definitely have to vet those different levels where it's like, you know, how deep of a cut is it? Like, you know, if you're pulling like, oh yeah, I heard of this band, you know, Pennywise before, it's like, okay, that's, right. You at least know something, but like that's, you know, not as deep. But yeah, where it's just like, oh, yeah, you ever heard of Playing Enemy? Where it's like, oh my gosh, like, okay, you really know what's up here. And so, exactly. Right, to like, you can fully relax with the Song of Zarathustra, you know, mention, whereas others, you'd be like, oh, okay, like I have to navigate a little bit differently around this.
Yeah, and it's been interesting also, you know, because sometimes you would go on towards, or, you know, you would be reflecting on that. And they'd be like, oh, where'd you play when you were in Tulsa? And I'd be like, oh, I don't know, some sort of somebody's house or something. And I feel like younger people, now they kind of get that because so many bands and so many musicians have kind of adopted just like the DIY approach, and playing a house show isn't bizarre at all. But, you know, 20 years ago, they were like, friends of yours? You know, that would be sort of the response. And they just couldn't really follow the thread.
Right. Yeah. Like, wait, so you didn't know them and they invited you into their basement to play? Really? It's like, right. That was where you did shows.
And then people would be kind of baffled. They're like, but you also told me you played at the House of Blues. And I'm like, yes, we do that too. You know?
Right. It's like, yeah, get a, you know, what's the saying? You know, get a girl or guy that can, you know, do you both. It's like, right. Yeah, we can play.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. We can play on the floor. Well, we'll pick apart some of those threads a little bit later, but there were, you know, as much as I've spent time with you and hung out with you, I haven't dove into your past, so to speak, as far as like, were you actually born and raised in Atlanta or did you come up somewhere else?
No. So I was born actually on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, in a little town called Port Townsend. And my parents were, they both worked for the Forest Service, and they had, they were kind of like back to the landers. Like they had both been in Tennessee and then just decided to go west and sort of connect with nature, touch grass and all that. And so I was born there, but then over time we, as a family, moved back east, and I grew up in Johnson City, Tennessee, and in Hendersonville, which is a Hendersonville, North Carolina, which is a suburb of Asheville. And then when I was probably 12 or so is when I ended up in just in North Atlanta, in Gwinnett County.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
So, yeah. So, I mean, really, I came of age in Atlanta, and it's always been, you know, the place I've returned to. But no, yeah, I mean, that's where I kind of really came into myself was in Atlanta.
Right. The Forest Service aspect, like that's, I mean, the not only, I actually just recently met a person who was like, you know, plays in a band or whatever, and like is a park ranger. And he's like, yeah, it's kind of weird because, you know, technically I am a Fed. And I'm like, oh yeah. I was like, I didn't think about it like that. But it's like, what exactly were your parents doing working for the Forest Service? Was it like, you know, just like literally monitoring forests and stuff like that? Or what was their task?
It was kind of like controlled cutting and controlled burns.
Sure.
My father would fly in on those the big helicopters that have the double blade kind, and they would him and a partner would be dropped down into these super remote areas, and they would, you know, log like every other log or whatever it is for the certain space. And then my mother was on the sort of the I don't think it was called, it could have been called the brush crew, but it's something like that essentially, where usually women would come in, or maybe smaller men, I actually don't know, would come in, and they would be the people that would move those logs and like strip them down so that they could be moved. So they did that for a while. I think my father briefly went into commercial logging, but he has some stuff that he never really shared this with me until like much later in life. But part of the reason he got out of the logging industry was that he started to feel that he could hear the trees like screaming out. Which is, you know, some obviously colorings of things that would come into my life later. But but he sort of had this, started to have this very intense emotional response to the work he was doing. So he eventually left that. And
Right. Well, I mean, especially too, like what you were saying, where what attracted them in the first place, and then, you know, you get pulled into different directions, but that idea that returning to your core belief of like, oh, why was I doing it in the first place to protect this stuff? And yeah, now the trees are reminding me that they don't want to be cut down. Right.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think maybe he just never shared that with me and my brothers. Maybe because when we were young, we wouldn't be able to grasp it, or maybe we would have thought he was losing his mind at some point.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, Dad, you need some help. We're gonna check you into a home a little bit earlier. Right. Yeah. So you mentioned brothers. How many siblings, and where did you kind of land in the totem pole?
So I'm in the middle, and I have an older brother who was born. I was actually born on his third birthday, so he's 3 years older than I am. And then I have a younger brother who's 9 years younger than I am.
Okay.
And my older brother, he lives in Salt Lake City, and he's a climate scientist. He's an expert in forest fires. Oddly enough, and I'm saying out loud, there's a weird theme there.
Yeah.
And he's an expert in beetle infestations. So.
Dude, I love the fact, and it's so, because I mean, yeah, you're like chuckling about that idea, but just like the fact that so many people can have these really specific disciplines in science, medicine, you know, earth science, whatever. And it's just like, well, yeah, of course someone needs to have that job. It just happens to be my older brother.
Right. Exactly. And it's interesting because what I do now is so much of like translating kind of like complex topics into, you know, 30-second videos or like kind of bite-sized things. And so often that's like he's very much in the realm of the kind of things that I'm translating. Although most of what I do is like humanitarian aid work, but it's interesting that he's kind of on the other side of it. But great guy, also plays music, really into music. And then I have a younger brother who's 9 years younger, and he is he's a professional musician, and he plays guitar. Up until recently, he was playing guitar for the soul singer named Curtis Harding. And he also does production work, and he lives in LA. So he was a little late to it. He was a radio engineer and did some production stuff. And then in his late 20s, he kind of got his act together and really,
right.
got immersed himself in playing music. So he's wildly talented. For the fact that I can't play a musical instrument.
Yeah, right, exactly. You're like, just give me a microphone and let me yell into it.
Yeah, exactly. When he told me he was learning how to play drums, I was like, could you not? Like,
yeah, you're like, you're really making me look bad here, guys.
Exactly.
Well, I do. That's it's cool to hear all of those different, you know, experiences of as far as like where you and your siblings have ended up, because they all, by any stretch of the imagination, you know, is a pretty unconventional path. Like, I mean, even though, you know, like obviously connecting your parents to working in the Forestry Service and what your older brother does, but just the idea that you guys were able to, you know, explore whatever you wanted to under the guise of like, well, I don't know exactly where I'm going to go with this, but I'm going to go somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think my parents, you know, they were people that they really came out of, you know, that sort of 60s, 70s mindset of letting kids kind of figure out what they want to do. My mother, she grew up a Air Force brat, so I think she wanted something that was much less structured. And I mean, they were super supportive to a point. I mean, at some point, especially with my younger brother, when they're like, come on, you got to get it together. But they were very supportive with all of us playing music and kind of trying on different things. Like, from a very, very early age, my father plays music, my mother plays music. So there were always instruments. There were guitars around the house. There was a piano in the house. So just always that, I mean, you know, when I started my first band in like seventh grade, my mother would let us practice, you know, all summer, all day, despite the phone calls to neighbors and things like that. So super supportive environment in that way.
That's, I love that. It really, the proliferation of 90s and, you know, 2000s, like punk and hardcore, was really only made possible because of, you know, kind parents. Like,
100%. Yeah. I mean, and you could see that a lot of the times, you know, when you would, I mean, even if it was the thing is, I mean, just access to equipment or being at a young age, being able to get to shows, like before, yep. You know, before I had any real friends that could drive when I was like 13 and 14 and trying to go downtown to go to shows or even shows that were happening locally. You know, my mother would just be like, all right, you know, just sort of like laugh at the people with mohawks or whatever it might be.
Oh boy, I got a treat for you. That is our friends at rockabilia.com. They have some amazing, amazing merch over there, and you need to order it by using this promo code 100 words or less. They stock over 500,000 items from bands as diverse as like, yo, you want a Jimi Hendrix shirt? They got you. How about a Bring Me the Horizon shirt? No problem. Or how about like a Cannibal Corpse long sleeve? Done. All of that stuff is all officially licensed. And that is very, very important to point out because let's be honest, there's a lot of bootlegs around and some terrible quality bootlegs. Like I just encourage you to never look at the horrible bootlegs that exist on Amazon. And plus, bands don't get paid for that. But Rockabilia is not about that life. So go to rockabilia.com. Use the promo code 100 words or less. It gets you 10% off your entire order. You win. The podcast wins. The business wins. They've been doing it for over 30 years. It's just incredible. So go check out rockabilia.com and use the promo code 100 words or less. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Ray.
Again, for reflecting on you as a person, you've always struck me. I mean, we've got along because of our levels of sarcasm and, you know, joking around with each other. But also, I've always admired your intelligence and sort of bookish nature, where it's like you definitely aren't the sort of person that, like, yes, you can be a total, you know, idiot goofball, but at the same time, you can also have conversations about, you know, either deeper emotional things or, you know, something that is of substance. Did you, care about school? Did you, you know, where were you, I guess, educating yourself if it wasn't at school?
Well, I think in some ways, because, you know, I was told pretty early on that I was a pretty bright kid.
And, sure.
I think that, I mean, like, it was one of those weird things where, you know, I would take an achievement test and like reflecting back and they're like, okay, well, you're in the 99th percentile for this and for this and for this. And it was this weird thing. I was like, oh, okay. Then what are you guys going to teach me? Which gave me sort of a stream of arrogance. And school, I mean, especially, you know, school was just kind of a breeze for me. Like, I never really gave much of a second thought. But I think because of that, I probably kind of did myself a disservice with learning sort of, I don't know, you know, or feeling like I really had to apply myself or like have any sort of real self-discipline to teach myself like new skills or something like that, because so much academically came really naturally to me, which maybe that sounds ridiculous, but you know, it was just like in school, it was things just weren't that challenging. But I was a really, you know, racist reader as a really young kid. I started reading, you know, any kind of new, like I'd read the newspaper every day when I came home from school. I'd read any magazine that was around, like was racist, like sort of appetite for like current media, which definitely, you know, I think informed kind of the things that I was pulled to when I started to get into music and like things that I would write about. And then, you know, it eventually sort of informed my entire career trajectory and work. But I don't know. But as far as just as I got older, then it definitely was, you know, things I was curious about. Then it got into the weird realm of, you know, when I was mail ordering records, I started to mail order books, and, you know, then downtown there would be, you know, all the different kind of bookstores that you could access, whether they'd be used bookstores, and then different kinds of, you know, literature distros and things like that at shows. But I was always kind of beyond like, you know, your flyers or your zines. I was definitely the kind of person that was like, oh, well, let me check out what's this, you know, what's the Society of the Spectacle thing. Let me talk about, let me get into all this stupid French shit and all this kind of thing.
Right.
Always trying to just kind of absorb as much as I could. But you know, school, I actually feel like I picked up a lot of good bit of knowledge from school. It just wasn't that challenging. Cause I was like, I love reading. Why would this be bad? You know?
Right. Right. And it does. I mean, to your point too, I think it does, like when you have that base of knowledge that you're just kind of adding on as, you know, I mean, whatever, what a precocious kid reading the newspaper as, you know, they get home from school and then maybe digging into homework or video games or whatever. It's like, that isn't a common experience. And so all you're doing is, you know, you're not articulating it at the time, but you're just making it easier to exist at school. Cause you're like, yo, I'm already doing the work on the side just because I care about this stuff.
Absolutely. And you know, in the newspaper, and that's what I kind of realized about, I mean, I'm sure I would have been just a total maniac if I'd had the internet when I was younger, but you know, the newspaper was like the kind of thing that it was filled with so much stuff. It was stuff that I was already interested in. It's like, you know, on Fridays you could see all the show listings for all these clubs that just seemed like magical locations when I was like 11 and 12 years old. So you could see all this stuff happening. And I knew, like, cause I was already completely obsessed with music of, you know, a pretty wide variety, but just knowing that it was like out there, you know, 20 minutes away, I was, you know, it was a lifeline. Not that where I grew up was particularly removed or rural or anything like that, but it was a sneak peek. It was like a preview of like, oh, this is like the stuff I want to be involved in. I want to know where these different clubs are. I want to know what these different bands are and all those things that are happening. And, you know, artist profiles, you know, profiles of musicians, all that kind of stuff. It just went straight into like the things that I was actually interested in.
Right. And I'm guessing based off of the description of, you know, your parents and your maybe older brother's influence, like were you kind of forging your own path in regards to the, you know, getting into the subculture and punk and hardcore and stuff like that? Or did you get little, you know, snippets from maybe your older brother?
I got little snippets, but he kind of went a different way. Like we were both, you know, we loved things like, we loved all the sort of like Britpop stuff that was happening, like Stone Roses and Oasis. And then, but right around the same time was like, you know, we were really into Helmet. We were into like Rollins Band. And he kind of went a different direction where he was interested in things that were a little bit more like the psychedelic jammy side. That was all kind of, you know, all that was kind of mixing together in like the early 90s with like, you know, the explosion of alt rock or whatever it might be. And then I was kind of like, well, you know, especially once Rollins Band kind of came into it, I was like, oh, okay, I want to dig into this. And that's like, you know, that's when I got to the Black Flag. And that's when I'm like middle school and I start mail ordering stuff from SST and then kind of figure out like, oh, you know, this is what is happening. Fugazi is still happening. It's like a viable thing. And that was a real sort of gateway for me.
Right.
Like realizing that it was, because that was, you know, that was another thing. It's like with the way that sort of the media portrayal and I guess sort of the narrative of like, this is what's happening with, you know, alternative rock as it sort of happened in, you know, I guess 1991 through like 93 or so was like, this is the natural evolution of punk. And so when I was, you know, 12, 13 years old, the stuff that you could kind of get your hands on easily, or not easily, that you had to know to look for it, was like the SST stuff and some of the early Discord stuff. And it was like, it all seemed like it had happened in the past. But then when I became aware of Fugazi and then almost at the same time became aware of like the local scene, which was a fairly hidden thing, and kind of I really had to dig for it in Atlanta. That was like that, you know, that was obviously life changing in a way that then it just became completely accessible in a way that I had no clue, but it had definitely been what I had been yearning for, you know, just a few years before.
Right. Yeah. And I love when you do make that connection that something is happening that you can touch and feel and go see or whatever, it becomes like, you're like, oh, so this is happening now as well, as opposed to, you know, either geographically so far away from you or, you know, like playing in a rock band in some arena or whatever.
Exactly. Or even, I mean, because my older brother was playing in bands and I would go with him and, you know, sometimes go see things, but it wasn't exactly what I was looking for, you know, even though they were playing like small, they were sometimes on, like, they were playing the same clubs that I would be playing in a few years or that I would be going to see shows at, you know, when I was in early high school or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, that was just completely mind-altering. And also that as soon as, you know, with hardcore, particularly in that era, when you realize that there is no, like you can be a band that's playing to no one and you can have a record out, or that, you know, all these sorts of things are just happening right there and there, and that you could do it. You know, that's, it all sounds super cliche, but it was just kind of like, you know, the first time you realize that, you know, the guy that like works at the comic book store plays drums in a hardcore band that's playing all the time. You're like, oh, okay.
Like, yeah. And like, yeah, I got this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So when did you start to, cause I mean, is Downpour wasn't your ostensibly like first band, was it?
No. So I was in a band, in middle school, and, actually several of the guys, like the most of the people, I think we started in like seventh grade and started to try to play shows, mostly like house shows. And that band was, it sort of sounded like Bad Religion or something. And okay. Then once we kind of figured out, I would say when we had Eye Against Eye and we had Break Down the Walls, we're like, oh, well, we'll never play like we're in the Bad Brains. Right. But we could do this youth crew shit all day long.
Yep.
So very quickly, we changed our name to Directed Youth and started playing shows and, you know, like just kind of became a very cookie cutter sort of youth crew hardcore band. But it was kind of ahead of it, but it was odd because, you know, at the time it was all like, you know, Snapcase and Earth Crisis was like the sort of the big thing happening right then in that moment. So we didn't know better in some ways because we hadn't been exposed to that stuff yet. We were still kind of coming out of this thing of like everything had happened in the past. So I was in this band called Direct Youth that played around for a few years, like early high school and late middle school. And the two of the guys went on to be in that band, Donna Ryan, the guy that played bass and played drums, who they were on Immigrant Son. And their actually their discography, I think, is about to be reissued. And then the other guy that played guitar is this guy, Joey Plunkett, who's played in this band, The Wait, for years. And then
And
he's in a new band now called Country Westerns that have put out a few just fantastic records that are on Fat Possum. And so he's like out in the world. And we're all – so, you know, everyone kind of like did that early on. And then, you know, as we got a little older, everyone continued to play in bands for quite a while. And Joseph and I are still, you know, great pals. Like, we see each other all the time. So it's, you know, still have that shared bond from years ago.
Right, right. And so when you started to, you know, tour, like that was more, a little bit more real when it was Downpour?
100%, yeah. So I would occasionally go out, you know, with Don O'Brien when they would go play shows, like they would go play Gainesville Fest or whatever it might be. But then I was friends with Ken, and Downpour had been around since like 96 or so. And before that, Ken and Brian had been in had been in Broken since like 92 or something. And so I joined Downpour, I think, in the end of 99 or 2000. And that was the first time we started to tour. And we really wanted to hit it hard because they had already recorded the Footsteps Over Our Head record, which was the full length that came out. And yeah. I think my third show was out of town. And then I just had this sort of maniac energy to want to go on tour. Because prior to that, the summer before I joined Downpour, which I guess was the summer after my first year of college, I went on tour with Indecision. And I was their merch guy for their last tour, where they broke up in Texas. So I really had the bug to go on tour.
Because you experienced all the high highs of Indecision tour.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Indecision was like in 2000, Artie was singing. And they had slimmed down. They were just a four piece. It was just Rachel and Justin and Pat by then. And then Artie was singing, and we were out with Killer Idols. And it was, you know, it was a really fun tour until it went off the rails with the band breaking up in El Paso, Texas. And everybody flew home besides me and Artie. And Artie and I then drove back across the country with all the equipment. And we stopped at Crazy Fest and just kind of had a wild few days there. And people were really mystified why he was there and why we were driving around in the Indecision van.
Right.
And that was a weird one because Artie also was really on his shoplifting crime spree kind of stuff.
Sure.
And he got arrested the last day of Crazy Fest. And me at like 18 or 19 years old trying to navigate the Louisville Police Department. And then finally, because he had only stolen a Gatorade, the judge told him that as long as he left Louisville by the time the sun went down, he was free to go.
Dude, total Southern justice right there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that had happened to me, and I came home early from that tour. And then shortly after that was when Downpour was doing the switch because their old bass player had quit. And Chris, who had been singing, decided he wanted to play bass. And so that's when I came to the fold with Downpour. So yeah, I just really had this appetite. Like there were a lot of, you know, there were Atlanta bands that were happening in the 90s, but like no one really was going on tour. And Ken and I and Jeff Jock were like booking shows all the time. And so we were coming into contact with all these different people that that made it seem easy and accessible, you know, or not necessarily easy, but you know, it seemed like the right thing to do. I didn't think that any bands that were coming through that we were booking were any better than like a lot of stuff that was happening in Atlanta. People just didn't seem to have the, you know, the drive or like the understanding of that it could be done.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
Our friends at evilgreed.net are the coolest. I love what they do. They open up web stores for bands across the spectrum, but the spectrum being heavy, cool, artistic stuff. And they sell merch for these bands. Like, I can throw a few band names out and you will be like, wow, that's really cool. I didn't know they do that. So you want to buy some Tsunami stuff? Boom, there we go. You want to buy some stuff from Triple B Records? There you go. How about Sgt. House? Awesome. Go to evilgreed.net. Use this promo code, 100 words. It gets you 10% off your entire order. The company is based in Berlin, Germany, but trust me in saying that you can order from them here in the United States. And for one, it does not cost that much. And for two, it ships out very, very quickly. So if you are looking for a one-stop shop to buy all things cool and hardcore and metal and punk, just go to evilgreed.net. They got it all for you, and you will be able to use the promo code 100 words for 10% off your order. And while you're at it, like, you know, maybe buy the new Ind record because they got that and it's really, really good. So evilgreed.net, 100 words is the promo code, 10% off. Now on with the show.
Atlanta was always this spot that, I mean, bands did make it through. And obviously, as you well know, from booking their shows and bringing them out there, but it definitely wasn't a place that, I mean, when you go to the South, it's like, well, I guess we got to go to the South, but you know, people are usually racing to either the West Coast or obviously the Northeast. And so you guys obviously had to create a lot of stuff on your own and probably had no choice but to, you know, build something from the ground up.
100%. Yeah. I mean, it was an interesting thing. Like, you know, Atlanta, the Carolinas to some degree, and definitely Florida, like people, there was a lot happening there. Obviously, you know, there's no idea. There were all those like Southern Florida bands like Culture and Morning Again. And then, you know, Carolinas, you had Catharsis and Zagoda and bands like that. But it was kind of – the South in general was fairly cut off or excluded a lot of the times from people coming through. Or it was a lot of people from those regions kind of playing in the cities that were nearby, which made total sense. But, yeah, with – I mean, that was part of it. To me – and it was something that was actually pretty eye-opening, pretty shocking when Downpour started to tour – was that we had to be pretty organized and had to really have everything in order and make shows really happen and like really flyer them, really push them, you know, put together weird, diverse bills to bring in, you know, just to max, because the scene wasn't gigantic. So you tried to maximize as many people that would come out. And going on tour with Downpour, you know, we were exposed to like just how half-assed a lot of people had it. Or just sort of the different levels of like, also like how integrated things like hardcore was with sort of like the traditional rock scene, like going to play places where like you would, it was just sort of the expectation that you were going to play at a particular club and that it would, you know, they would turn it over the next night for cover bands or something like that. And that was just very different than Atlanta, where it was all sort of like renting halls or opening our own venues. Or having like, you know, several of us lived in these warehouses, like all these different, you know, sort of pick a different warehouse in this one neighborhood in the West End of Atlanta. And it was like a different kind of punk. Like next door were all the dudes that loved the Clash, the Minutemen. Then you had us, so it was like, you know, the straight edge hardcore dudes. And across the alleyway was Matt Miller and his crew that were kind of like, they were, you know, same group, but they had a half pipe. So, you know, but you could do shows in each one of them. And sometimes, you know, Friday, Saturday night, there could be three different things happening there. But there was this sort of dedication, this like, I don't, like very early on, almost like a full immersion. Like it wasn't something you just did. It was kind of like, yeah, you just have bands play in our house, but also bands would be practicing there. And then also we would have a setup for, you know, printing, screen printing t-shirts or whatever it might be. So that was just very different because city to city, you kind of encountered a pretty big variety of people that didn't seem like they were as connected to it and didn't see it as a lifestyle as much.
No, I honestly, like, that's what, once I started to get to know people like yourself and others from Atlanta, it did seem very, like, for lack of a better term, like, you know, crime think, where it was basically like, yeah. Oh yeah. Once you've bought in, like, you are living on trains, you are dumpster diving. Like, yeah. I mean, not like you guys were doing some versions of that, but it was just like you said, you were pot committed. It was like, oh yes, you're going to live here. You're going to, you know, we're going to steal power from whatever local, you know, supermarket, like whatever.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, some of that stuff, like, I mean, I think some of the people in North Carolina that were like very aligned with that crime thing, they were more immersed in, like, yeah, they really took a bit more seriously. But I think definitely the idea of, you know, do whatever you can do to maintain your sense of freedom and like own your own time, that sort of thing was like very real. And so it was just sort of like, as soon as the warehouses kind of came into it, and this was, you know, there were so many people there of different stripes. That was the other thing that was cool about it. It's like there was such a like sort of artistic exchange that was happening. But you know, you kind of like, it's like taking almost all the cool people in a town and putting them into this like microscopic ecosystem.
Right.
And it really did create like all this sort of like interesting cross pollination and just, you know, it was pretty wild, especially explaining to people like that had no idea of what was going on. That you could just kind of float around this one neighborhood and all these different things could be happening. And that was very different because you were kind of immersed in some aspect of like DIY punk, like artistic sort of culture all the time. Like you didn't have to leave it necessarily. You might have to, you know, go to your job. Like I worked in a warehouse at a catering place for a good part of that time period. But, you know, I would go work my 8 hours and I would come back and it was, but also I just worked with other dudes that were in hardcore bands. You know what I mean?
Right. Totally. Yeah.
It wasn't like I was going to work at the CNN tower or something. So,
right.
Yeah. So yeah, it was very different. And Atlanta was very unique in that way because Atlanta had a lot going on for being, particularly in that time period, the '90s and the early 2000s, Atlanta was incredibly cheap to live. And I think that was a similar thing to a lot of places in the South that had similar sort of feeling. Like, I feel like Gainesville kind of felt like that. And there were a few other places. I mean, obviously, like, not necessarily Chapel Hill, but like Greensboro kind of had that going in North Carolina, where it was just like, you know, you could live, your rent could be $200 a month, which even back then, that was pretty easy to scrape together just working, you know, a couple days in a warehouse or at a burrito place or something. Yeah. And there was a lot of that. And then the rest of your time was yours to play in bands or do graffiti or, you know, photography, be into art, or just, you know, just, or then go on shoplifting sprees or whatever people were doing back then, you know?
Right. And the confidence of stepping into, you know, like screaming in a band and doing that, because I know you had experience before that, but was it a pretty easy transition for you to, you know, play in a band that was obviously going on tour and taking things, you know, more quote unquote more seriously, even though there wasn't really a path to, you know, create a career out of this?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was, I mean, honestly, like I was like getting the van pilled from a pretty early age. I was like, right. I was like, even though like you reread it, you know, late, the glamour, there's zero glamour there in that book, but just sort of that sense of adventure. I was like, yeah, what else am I going to do with my time? And I think definitely that exposure of going on tour with Indecision, I was like, okay, yeah, this is 100% what I want to be doing. So stepping into the role of singing, I mean, it was a little strange because, you know, I was 10 years younger than Ken and I was younger than all the rest of the guys by varying degrees. So coming in and being the front man of a band that was kind of like the established band in town. And then also there, I mean, you met the band. Like, I don't know if you ever met Brian's brother, but they were kind of like roughhousing, like jackasses, a little more southern, you know, like kind of like a grab ass kind of crew. So, you know, that was an interesting kind of thing to step into that role. But I think there was also kind of a sea change happening at that time where some people were kind of aging out of the people that had been going to shows like in the 90s. And there was like a whole new crop of people that were coming, as there always is. But it definitely felt, I mean, it was a lot more, I guess I should say, because around that time was also when, you know, 2000s, what that was like, when all the EVR stuff really started to pop off, and that really started to bring in a lot of new people, whether it would be, you know, Jane Doe came out, but at the same time, Saves the Day brought in like hundreds of new people to venues that they never would have discovered and all that kind of thing. So we were kind of, me coming in and singing for Downpour kind of all happened at that same time. So it felt, right. You know, right.
And, like I was saying, with the idea that it was just, there was no, the only pursuit that you were focused on was like, well, yeah, like I want to be, you know, creative, artistic, follow this, you know, touring path. Like there was no, you know, clear career goals or what have you. But obviously your interests outside of playing in a band and stuff like that were, you know, always pretty clear to, at least to me, like once I got to know you. And then, the idea of the business person of the band, you know, like that always either, you know, fell on you or Ken from that perspective. But did you, I guess, enjoy the business of the band? I use that in air quotes because, you know, getting paid $100 for a show is like obviously still business, but, you know,
yeah.
Did you enjoy that aspect?
I think I did. And I think it, honestly, I mean, because I started booking shows when I was in ninth grade or something, you know, so I was like 15 and still having to get a ride to my own shows. So just doing that, you know, and being so quickly immersed in that side of things, it just felt like a natural sort of extension of that. You know, I was already booking bands on one end, so I could just flip it around and be like, all right, well, if we do this, what can you do? That sort of thing.
Right.
But yeah, no, it felt totally natural. And, you know, it was only like later, I would say, like when the Power and the Glory was going, when people started to get managers, and like it seemed like almost every band had a booking agent or something for a brief period of time, which there was this odd sense of like professionalism that started to creep in, I would say, like by 2005 or 2006. And that felt a little foreign, but I was, you know, I was also kind of interested in it because I wanted someone else to take over things at that point. Right. I was like, all right, I've had enough of this. I'm trying to shake some kid down and, you know, in Alabama or something for the $50 in his pocket. But, no, doing all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I think it helps. And also no one else is going to do it. Like just as far as like booking our shows and, just dealing with it. I think I was the most naturally suited towards it.
Sure. Sure. And, I know that you, I mean, obviously working with Deathwish on the last Power and Glory record and their, you know, the idea, cause at that point, correct me if I'm wrong, but you had actually moved, you and Ken had moved up to the Boston area to like work at Deathwish Bridge 9 for a while, right?
Yeah. So when we did, we were still living in Atlanta when we recorded that record. And then it was a little unclear what was going to happen with the record because Brian, our drummer, wanted to finish school. He'd been going to engineering school. And Ken and I decided, you know, we were open to the idea of trying something new. And we had gone up to when Bridge 9 and Deathwish were sharing an office in Salem. And we liked this idea of, you know, trying out being like full-time professional punks, you know what I mean? Like just seeing what they had put together and seeing kind of the infrastructure they had going, you know, especially with, and I think this is still true in many ways of what Jake and Trey have managed to do with Deathwish and what Kurt had managed to do with God City. And it was, you know, it was nowhere near where it is now. Like Kurt wasn't polishing his Grammy yet. But, you know, like just this idea and what Chris was doing with Bridge 9, it was really impressive just to be like, you know, these guys, once again, it was that kind of thing of like, well, it doesn't seem like they have anything that we don't have just as far as this drive to want to do something that's independent and that we're in control of. And I think, you know, there's that was sort of the that was the appeal of it. And just seeing these people that, you know, kind of through their drive, they were kind of creating their own reality. So it really, it was an extension of the idea of like a full immersion, you know, like it was a little different because it was when it becomes your job, then you do want to retreat from it a bit more.
Right.
You know, you want to have a house that you go home and wash your clothes at. And so it would have been, I thought about if it had been that combo of like still living in the warehouses, still having to hear, you know, a band practice like 6 days a week. And then I also was going to the office and, you know, talking about how many shirts Slumlords needed printed or something.
Right. Totally.
That would have been probably been a lot, but no, it was, so Ken and I moved up there. We went into business with Chris Wren and we helped him start Liberated Images, which is still around today. And, yep. With doing screen printing. And, you know, it was an interesting year. I didn't really take to Salem or to Boston, but it was during that year we were already working with Death Wish, but the record came out that year. And then Ken and I decided to go back to Atlanta, started playing with Brian again, and pretty quickly we got a new bass player and went on tour for like most of 2005 after that.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to dive into the, because you eventually ended up in New York and worked at, you know, Vice in the early years. I know Vice now means something completely different than it did when you were working there. I imagine that those years, basically most of what you were doing felt, I mean, not maybe you personally, but most of maybe what everybody was doing in there was like borderline illegal. Like it still seemed like it was trying to grow up as a company, but then obviously, you know, like clearly a lot of Vice stories exist.
Yeah.
I'm not looking for, you know, any dirt, so to speak, but was your experience like basically reflective over those stories, or was it like, oh my gosh, like I'm just trying to keep my head above water here?
I think actually, because when I was there, it was, I guess it was 2010 and 2011. It was an interesting period for Vice because they were kind of starting to move out of some of the stuff that seemed like very sketchy. You know, there was this sort of, there was an attempt at legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And there was things like, you know, you'd be in a meeting and people were like, oh, how's it going to play in China or something like that? And I'm like, are you just saying that?
Right.
Because you read it somewhere. But no, I mean, I think with Vice, I think that was my first real exposure to people that, well, maybe not my first exposure, because I feel like what I was saying earlier about sort of this people, like their attempt at professionalism, it was my first real exposure to people that seemed like they had become, if they weren't always, just fully cynical in a lot of ways about engaging with certain aspects of culture. And it was interesting because, like, you know, I played a part in it, you know, whether it be something like putting together, you know, music writing or different kind of projects that was related to, you know, like Vitamin Water or something was paying for it.
Sure.
Which is all fine and good, really. You know, all those Scion Fests, those were fun. People got paid. People,
yep.
You know, all that kind of thing. In a lot of ways was probably a net positive for people that were playing those shows. And for me, for working on projects like that. But I think with Vice, it was maybe the first time I'd ever seen people where it was like, oh, this, their principal concern is 100% the bottom line. And it was an odd sort of mix of like people that really were very creative and like genuinely interested in, creative work and advancing the work of other people, kind of, you know, coming into direct contact with people that really only had one principal driving thing, and that was money. And then also, you know, I was there, I think, when they were trying to get the valuation over $1 billion, I think it was the magic number at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was just really interesting to sort of just even get flashes of those conversations, because I wasn't necessarily in those meetings, you know.
Right. Yeah, do you just hear stuff happening around you where it's just like, what? Oh, okay. I guess that's what we're going for.
Yeah, 100%. And that on top of just moving to New York and like the whole thing kind of being a bit of a culture shock. even with as much time as I had spent there prior to that. But yeah, I mean, working advice though, it was helpful because it did sort of, definitely pushed me along as far as like skills and ability to relate to people with completely different backgrounds, but also just to kind of take the different kind of things that I had in a lot of ways, come to or started to refine when I was much more deeply involved with hardcore, and realized that a lot of those skills could sort of be applied to a lot of different kind of work and a lot of different kind of situations. Right. Yeah, it was interesting. But yeah, I mean, advice was, I'm definitely glad I did it. And it was it was also crazy because you realize just how out of, so many people were just completely out of their minds in a variety of ways.
Totally.
Different people, like when the wheels fall off for them, it happens at different times and different things trigger it. But you're like, oh, you were just like on another planet for like that whole year that I was working with,
Which totally.
There's aspects of my life that have definitely had that in it. But it was, it was definitely sort of a, it was a useful experience. It was a good, good thing to do.
And kind of like tacking onto that, just the idea, like, your work in like the media world and obviously the advocacy that you do and everything, like you've always been attached to the creative pursuits. It seems like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like obviously the longer that this, punk hardcore subculture has existed, that the more, people that are professional human beings, but also have those, pasts of either playing in bands or still playing in bands or whatever. Do you run into, I guess maybe a decent amount of people that have that experience, or is it still kind of just like really random and not as often as you might think?
I think I definitely did when I was more, I see it less now. So currently I work for an international non-governmental organization that does all sorts of humanitarian work around the world. And I run into it less now, but I think when I was just more fully engaged in media and journalism and just, like general creative work, like every other graphic designer from a certain time period, they probably were in a band at some point, or they're like aware of a lot of different things that, I would have been connected to, or that I was aware of. So definitely, but, there are people, that seem to run in this world to some degree, but I don't run into them as often with this. And I think a lot of people that want to do this kind of work are people that were very much, they wanted to be policy wonks. I don't know when you get that bug because I still don't have it and never will. Sure. I translate all this kind of stuff into messages that I hope people can sort of understand and latch onto, and it has some sort of emotional or intellectual trigger for them. But I think what you're saying is like as time goes on and so many people come out of it or continue to be, involved in it. In some ways it's interesting to me and kind of a little surprising. I'll drop that. We can cut that there, but.
Sure. That's fine.
Yeah. I was kind of thinking through. In this world, I don't see it as often, but I definitely do encounter more and more people that have the experience of playing in bands that are connected to the hardcore punk world in a way that honestly, I would have never predicted when I was younger. Like even when I was doing it, I would have never predicted that, just sort of the size and scope and the fact that it's just continued to grow and grow without even really mutating in any way that's completely unrecognizable to me.
Right. It's true. And also that idea that because, punk and hardcore is clearly a youth-based culture and movement, and now the fact that people have to grasp, you know, what aging gracefully means or whatever. It's just like, oh my gosh, I guess I have to think about what it's like to go to a show in my 40s and 50s. And I would always look at people in their 30s at shows and be like, oh my God, what is that monster doing in the back or whatever? And
absolutely.
Right. But no one really had to think about that, because it's like, it seems like it almost, you know, by design, people drop it when they're in their mid 20s and then move on with their life. And then that's kind of it. But it's like, now you don't, most people don't do that. They still have a general awareness or care about it in some capacity.
Yeah. And that was something that, I mean, that never happened. Like, something that I've always kind of reflected on is the idea of like who, when I was going to shows and I was, you know, young, like even by like 94, 95 or something, 96, like who was going to hardcore shows that had seen Black Flag play in Atlanta in 1986? And it was like two people.
Right.
And now like 10 years will pass and, you know, like bands like Foundation were around for more than 10 years. And the only reason I cite them is like, they seemed like a young band that was like very much, I know they're not a young band now, but
yeah, they're like a new band to you. Right. I get it.
Yeah, they are. I'm like, oh yeah, the demo was cool. I like that song. It's like Snapcase. but no, just that like a band, that bands would exist that long. And then there would still be the tail of people and still being involved. It just wasn't a thing, you know, especially in Atlanta, because it was just so, it was just, yeah, like you were saying, it's just a thing that you did. And I think that was true most places. Like people, if someone was 30 and in a band, they were just like, you know, they were a lifer. They were here forever.
Right.
Which yeah. Just did not happen. And then, you know, it seems like now when I go to shows or something, that quite often bands are maybe not my age, maybe not your age, but, you know, there's a lot of people that are in their 30s, which was something that was just not the case at all.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And on that notion, the last thing I'll hit on with you is the idea that because you have always, you know, cared about this subculture and pay attention to it, you know, varying degrees, like you were joking about when we weren't recording, of like, oh, you know, maybe I needed to beef up on some of my, you know, hardcore knowledge or whatever over the past 10, 15 years, but you still like, you know, you care about it. You obviously have friends involved with it. What, I guess what keeps you attached, excited? Is it just that obviously the shared experience, or is there something deeper than that?
No, I mean, I think, that's a good question. I think it's a variety of different things. You know, I think even time periods where I felt kind of alienated from it, that was probably just more reflection of like where I was in my life and like even needing to have some sort of distance or feeling like maybe not feel so dependent on a certain aspect of my identity. But I think now, you know, at the age I'm at, I definitely can kind of see the utility and the function that it serves for other people, you know, and to see that reflected over and over again in people's involvement. And then, like we're saying, to see like all the different directions that people go when they have the experience of being immersed in hardcore, but, you know, more than that, and just sort of like that DIY sort of ethic and the interest to want to connect with people and to see the world in sort of through this different lens. You know, I see why it's useful and what it does for a kid. You know, if they were 10 years younger than me at one point, now they're in their mid 30s and they're starting their own business, or they're, you know, they're doing something that's, you know, pretty radical, or things that are at least that are pretty interesting. And, you know, I can see that their experience that's so similar to mine, really informed them, sent them on like a more interesting path. And so I think there's always that, but then also, you know, like, you know, I still like the music. There's a lot of stuff that like I don't think ages well or didn't age well. Maybe records that I was on, but maybe some did.
Sure.
I like a lot of it. I like a lot. I'm proud of the work that I did with both bands. But you know, it's definitely like I still like to hear new bands. I like to hear a new twist on it, and I like to hear stuff that's, you know, people that I would love
a new Botch song. You'd be like, okay, that's cool. I'll listen to that.
You know, I like stuff like the Chisel. Like, that's great. And that's like, you know, really straightforward, but it's got a little bit of a twist on it. And or like that high viz stuff, like all these kind of new bands where it's like, you know, it doesn't have to be rocket science, but I'm still excited to hear people do it. And I'm excited, like, you know, when my friends that are still doing it, I'm excited to hear their records. I may not, you know, wear them out listening and get multiple repeated listens, but I'm excited. And, you know, I still love to go see bands play when it's a band that I'm interested in. And it's, you know, it's still energizing to see, you know, new bands or old bands that are still doing it and, like, you know, having a good time doing it.
Boom, there you go. Hopefully you learned some about him. You learned something about the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s hardcore scene in the South, just because that was a very vital thing. And it still remains vital. So just pay attention to that. Anyways, next week I have the final installment of the live conversations I had at New England Metal and Hardcore Festival. This one is a split 7-inch, as it were, with Alexander Jones from Undeath and Ryan Story from Gates to Hell. Two, like, absolutely incredible death metal, whatever classification you want to put on them. Just heavy, awesome stuff. And I decided to put them together for an awesome split 7-inch, so to speak, in the audio form. Well, technically, a split 7-inch is in the audio form, but you get it. Anyways, until then, please be safe, everybody.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.